This is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Charles Paquette, recorded on March 27, 2012, in the Bay Street Armory's JR's Mess, interviewed by Stefan Conquist. Bombardier Paquette, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes.
Hello, I'm here as part of the University of Victoria's Veterans Oral History Project. I'm a student gathering interviews in order to help preserve the memory of Canada's mission in Kandahar, Afghanistan. Paquette, where are you from?
I was born and raised in Quebec City, and at the age of 8, I came over to Victoria.
Right on. When and why did you join the Canadian Forces Army Reserves?
Something I always wanted to do, and I like the challenging aspect of it.
What unit did you end up joining?
5th Field Artillery, here in Victoria.
That's my unit as well.
Excellent.
What military trade did you choose when you enlisted? Do you want to describe that trade to me in your own words?
Yeah, artillery, which our role is to maintain and operate the 105mm howitzer, which is an indirect fire weapon. We basically maintain it in a crew of 7 to 9 people. And there's also the technical aspect of the trade, which is either command post or recce aspect, which are essential to aim and fire these weapons.
How long were you with this reserve unit before going overseas, and what kind of training did you do with them?
I joined in 07, so I was in this unit for 3 years before going over. And,
Did you do much live fire training with your unit?
Before tour? Yes, we go over to Washington State to fire live twice a year.
Right on. Now, before the tour itself, what kind of training do you do on your workup? Where did it take place?
We are sent in Wainwright for 2 months. That's for a final confirmation, which they have a whole Afghanistan-based scenario over there where we actually practice our jobs. Before then, I was in Valcartier in Quebec, and I trained with my battle group, the Bantus. And I trained with simulators, because I, with my job overseas, which was controlling aircraft, we couldn't do that more often than we wanted to, so we use simulators.
Presumably, live fire with aircraft would get pretty expensive pretty quickly, and there aren't a lot of places you can do it, so the simulator is pretty valuable, I'm guessing.
Exactly.
What kind of simulator facilities did they have? Could you describe?
Yes. Kingston had a big network of computers, which simulated the whole command post aspect of it, and we had an air crew that would simulate the aircraft and would input data to create aircrafts in the system. And the system was basically a video game where it was called VBS, which is a video game, and we just controlled our people on the ground to do a job there.
What did you think of using the actual equipment, like laser rangefinders and such, to perform this job during training in the field?
It was good. It was good. Good knowledge of new equipment that we don't see in the reserve. Like you said, operating a laser rangefinder, which is a huge, huge help to our job. Also, Falcon View, which was basically a military version of Google Earth, which had satellite images of the map. We also got to play around with a Rover Fives, which is a program built on a small laptop, and that picked up frequencies from aircraft. That enabled us to see what the aircraft saw. Example, target pods for bombing targets.
Like a visual image?
Yeah.
Wow, that's neat. I didn't even know that existed. Mm-hmm. And all of this stuff is for your job, which was specifically as an assistant to the FU or FAC.
Yeah, I was a TACP, Tactical Air Control Party, and we were in a party with FU FACs, or just simply FACs. And I was a mix of, basically I was in charge of all the equipment, make sure the rover worked, the radios worked, and if the FAC was busy or getting shot at, I was the guy that knew the order to call in a plane and to carry on the procedures. And I knew how all the equipment worked, so that was my job.
Was your group or party mounted in a vehicle?
When we were out of the FOBs, the forward operating bases, we were in a Coyote, so mounted in a vehicle. And if not, then we stayed in the command post in our TACP area.
Who else were you training with? What did you think of your section, platoon, or company during pre-deployment training?
We had a good bunch of guys. We trained with the Van Dues, the 1st Battalion of Royal 22nd Regiment. And it was good. And overseas, we even got to work with some other countries, like the American fighters, the Dutch Air Force, French Air Force, British, which was really interesting to see all the different aspects of different countries.
Well, I'll love getting into that later. But first, what was it like when you actually got in Canada for the first time?
It was definitely the biggest shocker was the smell and the dust, a lot of dust. And yeah, the smell was pretty bad because on the main base, Kandahar, there's a old sewage pond which is obviously overflowing and had problems.
What were your first couple days like after touching down in Kandahar Airfield?
It's pretty go-go-go mode. What I mean by that is you get your ammo, your rifle, you fire your weapon to see if it works correctly, you do your mine-clearing drills, get your gear, and then a couple days on the base, after you get the intro, you're sent off to a forward operating base, which was my case, and the rest of the journey just follows.
Which forward operating base did you get pushed out to initially?
FOB Zangabad, which was in the Horn of Panjwani.
How many hours from CAP is that by ground, or did you get flown in?
I got flown in by helicopter from the ground. It was, I'd say, a good 2 hours.
And is that an Gripen or a Chinook?
A Chinook.
What was your operational unit's duties in Kandahar?
Personally, when I was in, do you mean sorry, the Kandahar base or Kandahar province?
I'm talking about the province.
Okay,
yeah.
My duties were to make sure the guys on the ground, the battle group, had air support and air cover at all times.
Now, you were part of the battle group, correct?
Yes, right. And, yeah, I make sure that air has its in the air, ready. So, support helicopters, attack helicopters, UAVs, and jets. I make sure they had cover during operations, or even if it was a dead zone, then it's always good to have those assets in there.
Do you work with any other units or organizations, even other nations?
Yeah, like I mentioned earlier, different countries, different air forces from different countries, Dutch, French, English. Those were the main ones. And yeah, it's very different. For example, the French speak in very, very broken English. And me being French, I wasn't allowed to speak French to them because it's standard voice procedure on the radio to talk in English. So it was very frustrating at times. And yeah.
How do you feel about the Americans, who probably had the biggest presence in Kandahar at that time?
Yeah, I'd say 70% of the airdrops we did was with American jets, being the A-10s, the Warhawk. And they're very familiar with their job. They always practice, and we can tell overseas because they were not an attempt, they would drop on target.
Are there any specific events or situations you'd like to share?
There was one operation which followed Tango Company, which is the armored part of a battle group. And we were in a coyote with a bunch of FACs, and we had two A-10s to support the operation. And as the armored advanced, they came in contact with a group of insurgents, around two or three, I can't remember. And actually, we had an American consul that was with them, with the tanks. And there was a problem with identifying where the insurgents were exactly, because the Canadians would give a coordinate, but the Americans would give a different method of giving a coordinate. So that was again a problem with working with different countries, but we adapted, and luckily we had A-10s to support us, and they did a strafe, a flyby using their 30 millimeter, and the insurgents were gone, and the operation was able to carry on, which was good.
Do you remember when this happened, Ralph?
This was before the summer season, maybe around June. Yeah, a bit before June.
And which roto were you deployed on?
Roto 10.
Roto 10. Now, what other kinds of equipment did you use in country? You know, personal protective equipment, or we talked about vehicles earlier. Anything of note you'd like to talk about?
Like I said before, the rovers were a great asset, great help, which allowed us to see what exactly the jets saw. And even they could pick up video feeds from UAVs, and some feeds were very precise. I wouldn't say HD quality, but it's close from there. And these UAVs would fly at some of them would fly close to 30,000 feet, and a very clear image. Also, like Stefan, like you mentioned earlier, personal gear, the frag vest and tactical vest, laser rangefinders also, which helped us get a bearing and distance of what we saw, and we were able to report back to the aircraft the exact distance of the target.
So you'd say everything you got was pretty effective.
Yeah, I'd say.
Good to hear. Do you do much traveling around the province?
No, not necessarily. Apart from Zangabad and that area and Kandahar base, that was mostly where I was.
Do you move around at all by air, or was it all ground?
I'd say 40% was by air, and the rest was along with our convoy. Or company within the battle group with light armor vehicles.
Now, partway through your tour, where did you decide to go for home lead travel assistance?
I decided to go to France, southern France, in a village called Saint-Tropez, and I spent my whole HLT there, so the whole 19 days. And it was good. I've been to France before then, so I knew I wanted to go back. So
it was good this time, too.
Yes. Yeah. Good weather.
Meet a lot of friendly people.
A lot, yeah.
Always good to hear. do you feel that your HLTA helped with the rest of the deployment?
Yeah, for sure. It was my HLTA was at the end of the tour, so it's something I was looking forward to, and it was a goal.
What was the combined length of your tour?
It was 8 months.
Including the HLTA?
Including HLTA, yeah.
Do you remember the approximate start and end dates?
Yes, it was November 2010 till June 2011.
Right up until near the end of Operation Athena, huh?
Yeah.
Any other specific events or situations you'd like to share?
The biggest thing I'm proud of about our rota and our battle group is the pavement of the road Hyena, which is the main highway that travels through the Horn of Pandui, which I know in your time was a pretty rough area.
If memory serves, that was the one going around to PBS, or Patrol Base Sturmungar.
Yeah,
that was a dirt road.
And it
washed away during the rainy season.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't paved in 09.
And that dirt road was very, very difficult for us to travel through because it was easily filled with mines and IEDs. And on our road, our engineers actually paved the whole thing through all the way to the Horn, which was a dangerous area in your time. And for us, it was still dangerous, but being there in that smaller area, we were able to control more and finish that road for us and for the people.
I'd definitely like to see a photo of that, actually, because I've been to PBSG many, many times. And yeah, that was one of the worst routes, other than the stuff, you know, north of the Kandahar and the Argandab Desert. But moving on, based on how your tour went with your, you know, training and equipment, people you're going with, do you feel workup training sufficiently prepared you for what happened?
Yes, it was. I spent a good 6 months training beforehand, so definitely you get the basics out of the way, and you get it's just enough time for the drill to step in and to be a routine in what you do. But obviously, there's some things that doesn't prepare you, like weather conditions and stress management, and you know, all that stuff.
Now, going back to the second half of your tour, you said you worked a lot with other countries. Any other nations you'd like to talk about or call out in your time as a Canadian soldier in Kandahar?
Like I said before, the French, very frustrating with communication. Because again, I couldn't speak my native language to them because aircraft procedure is to speak English with them. And also the British, which is the reverse of that. I had difficulty hearing what they were saying because of their accent. But you get to learn to work with each different country in your own way, and it all worked out in the end. So.
Now, what were the British flying?
The GR4, which is the Tornado.
And the French?
The French had the M2000 Mirage.
Oh.
And they also had the Super Etendard, which actually, for them, they don't fly two Mirages side by side. They use a Mirage and a different aircraft, which is the Super Etendard, to complete each other. So if one's rover feed didn't work, then they couldn't rely on the other aircraft because actually only one aircraft had that feed. So here's another challenge to
work
with.
Sounds unusual, yeah. And what kind of munitions would they generally be using?
They all had the 20mm cannon except for the A-10, which had the 30mm gun. And obviously they have GBU-12s, which were 500-pound bombs. Some of them, some have 1,000-pound bombs, which were the F-15s. And they roughly carry between 2 and 5 bombs per aircraft.
You see those get dropped very often, 500 or 1,000 pounds?
Yes, every day. There was strafes every day, and bombs were dropped every day.
Pretty accurate, I'd say? Or?
Yeah, for the guns, for the A-10s, they were 9 out of 10 on target. Bombs, since they were laser guided, sometimes the laser had it's accurate within, I think it's between 1500 meters, but there were some misses, some didn't detonate, but you know that stuff happens, but most of the time they were accurate, yes.
Yeah, duds are inevitable, just like artillery.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm just assuming here, but from the tactical perspective, the fast air is probably a lot faster than artillery, the Canadian artillery that would have been deployed there at the time. Did you ever get to see that, seeing as you were deployed with the Foos?
Yeah. I especially noticed that when I was working in the battle group command post, where everything happens. We had the artillery beside us, and when there was a contact, my boss, the major of the battle group, would always choose air over artillery, which kind of had a rivalry because me being artillery, but they would always have air because it was just so much easier and so much quicker. But yeah, that was the preferred method.
And I'm guessing that it's a pretty decisive weapon once it's used.
Yeah.
The contact would be fast.
Yeah. And there's also the intimidation level of having the aircraft above you. Like, even if we didn't drop anything, just doing a flyby over a suspected area, definitely it achieved what we wanted in the enemy, which was either to disperse them or...
Yeah, presence can be a big factor, so I understand what you mean. Nothing says presence like an aircraft flying over it. You know, what is low to an aircraft? 1,000 feet?
1,500 feet? Show of force was done, I'd say, from 1,000 meters to 2,000 meters. Yeah. Actually, correction. No, it was 3 to 5,000 meters. Yeah. Because you'd have helicopters flying below that.
Right. Now, the helicopters themselves, I'm presuming you worked a lot with them as well. Can you describe them in detail in operation?
Yeah. They were obviously more frequent than the aircraft, so we worked with them a lot too. What we did most of the time is just pass them along to the infantry call signs, let them deal with the helicopters, because we had also UAVs to deal with and fast air. So we just pushed them to the guys on the ground, which they talked directly to over the radio, so they could support, you know, their own section-sized operations.
Any good memories of an op where a helicopter was present doing its thing? I'm guessing this is generally the AH-64 Apache or the Kiowa Warrior, both American helicopters. Am I right?
Yes, the Apache and the Kiowas. We use a lot of the Kiowas. I can give you an example. We spotted two guys in a group field with their Predator UAV. But that Predator didn't have any bombs on him anymore because it got used earlier. Anyways, we instead of using the fast air, we decided to go with the Kiowas because they were closer. And they could spot those targets way easier than the guys on the ground because they had an overview of the area rather than having troops or even with a jet, it's way harder to clear the airspace than to use the C6 or machine gun on the helicopters. So it made life easier for sure.
Oh, good. Well, I imagine recce is, or reconnaissance is very important. When you're ground level in a built-up area, you really know virtually nothing about where you are. It can be pretty frustrating. So it's good to see that those UAVs are so effective. See them flying around once in a while. Never really knew they had that high resolution. Now, the helicopters and the UAVs, they carried weapons as well. Obviously, the helicopters did. Do you mind going into a little more detail on that?
Yeah, for sure. I'll start with the UAVs. We had a full range of different kind of UAVs. We got the smaller ones, which were S-UAVs, which the ScanEagle came into that category, which was about the size of a coffee table, I'd say. And it was a small UAV. The resolution of the video wasn't too good because of camera size and the bird size, too. But it's definitely more, it was lower, so it was easier to detect at night because the sound would travel. There's other types of UVs like the Heron, which is Canadian, which we only have two Canadian UVs in Canada, which was the Heron and the Scaneagle. Heron flew at around 20,000 feet, which had a good picture also. Brits and Americans had the Predator and Reaper. Predator and Reaper are very similar aircrafts. Small differences is mostly the amount of bombs they carry. Predator usually carries one Hellfire, which is a laser-guided bomb, sorry, missile. And Reaper usually had two Hellfires and one GBU-12, which is a 500-pounder. And to go over the Scaneagle and Heron again, they were not armed. It was just strictly recce birds. Now, for the attack helicopters, the Apaches had the Gatling gun, and they had 7mm rockets, I believe. Yes, and same with the Kiowas, which are smaller helicopters, more used in a scout recce mode. Again, with the 7.62 machine gun and 7mm rockets.
And they're around every day.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting to hear about all the stuff that's going on in the sky. It sounds pretty busy up there.
Yeah.
A lot of managing of different aircraft. Now, once you had left or started, you know, getting ready to leave, did you get replacements for your operational unit?
Because we were the last Canadian battle group to be overseas, we actually didn't get relieved by Canadians. It was a slow changeover with the American. The American HQ headquarters actually was taking over our area of operation. So it was definitely easier in a way because it wasn't a description of each job to a different person. It was mostly a gesture how to give up an area to another country. So it was smoother and easier than the previous year, I believe.
Well, how did that go, giving up the area to the Americans?
It was definitely hard for some people because some people were on the third tour, and knowing the area pretty well, it was kind of a part of them were kind of giving the accomplishments to someone else to carry over. So it was kind of it was hard for them, I guess, because it was just kind of all that they worked for is in the hands of another group.
Yeah, so a lot of a lot of sacrifices, a lot of time, a lot of effort. But once you did hand it over, where did you go for decompression?
Our battle group was sent to Cyprus, which in the previous years was that's where all the Canadians went, and that was good. That was 4 days there. We got sent in a resort, and there was various activities that were organized there for us. For example, a Cyprus wine tour. There was a visit of the old Greek temples and Athena's tomb and whatsoever.
Yeah, good to hear. Now, after that, how did your trip back to Canada go? What kind of reception did you receive when you got there?
As good as obviously a moment that we're all waiting for. And once we get on the military aircraft and all the excitement's there. And we got greeted, once we crossed the Canadian airspace, we got greeted by two F-18s in the air, which basically welcomed us and escorted to the airport in Quebec City. And once I was there, I got to meet up with my uncles and aunts in Quebec City. And then from there, all the way back to Victoria. The moment of seeing your family and friends is obviously a very, very good moment. And very, very happy to come home.
You just okay back in Canada? working with your reserve unit again?
Yeah, it was good. I got the routine back and going, and after some rest, and it was very...
I know, I was happy
to be home. Yeah. Yeah.
Got back in your tents.
Yeah.
That was quite a day. Any final comments you'd like to share about the way your tour went? Any equipment, anything like that? Or just coming back to Canada?
Nothing I can think of right now.
Okay, no problem. Well, in that case, I'd say this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Charles Paquette on the 27th of March, 2012. Thanks for your time, Charles.
Thank you.
And I'm just going to confirm, we have both signed the interview release form. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay, thank you.